Dit is die middel van die week en amper die helfte van die dag en dit beteken dit is tyd vir gesondheid op RSG. Ek gesels vandag verder oor hoe jou immuunstelsel op COVID en op die vaksine reageer. En my gas is weer professor Jonathan Peter, hy is hoof van kliniese immunologie en allergie aan die Universiteit van Kaapstad se mediese skool en Grote Schuur Hospitaal en ook verbonde aan die Universiteit van Kaapstad se Long Instituut. Professor Peter het enkele belangrike punte uitgelig en ek gee net 'n baie kort opsomming daarvan. As daar vreemde virusse, bakterieë of ander indringers jou liggaam probeer binnendring, is daar verskeie linies hoe jou liggaam probeer keer dat hierdie vreemde ding jou aanval. Die eerste linie is natuurlik fisieke skanse soos jou vel, jou slijmvliese in jou neus en jou keel en jou longe. Dan die volgende linie behels die aktivering van selle en hierdie selle is verskillende soorte wit bloedselle. Die selle kan dan opgedeel word in 'n algemene reaksie en in baie spesifieke reaksie. En hierso is basies twee verskillende baie belangrike spesialiseenhede. Die B en T selle is die wat hulle noem die geheuselle. Hulle is baie spesifiek gerig teen 'n spesifieke virus. Gestel jy het die vaksin gekry en hulle word dan geaktiveer. Dan, wanneer die werklike virus jou binnendring, is hulle absoluut gereed en sal hulle baie vinnig op daai virus spring. Gaan kyk gerus op RSG se webblad, rsg.co.za, daar is baie interessante agtergrondinligting oor inflammasie en die immuunrespons gelaai. Ek sit nou my gesprek voort met professor Johnny Peter, waar ons verlede week afgesluit het, is hoekom die immuunrespons na 'n tweede vaksin soms erger is as na die eerste een.
Yes, it's actually interesting. So there are those reactions, you know, obviously I work in allergy. So I'm at the moment getting everybody that's having some kind of an allergic reaction to the vaccines. And what we're seeing, which is very interesting there, is we're seeing that sort of allergic symptoms, like some people are getting a rash after the vaccine, or some people might have a sort of a bit of a tight chest related. And what we're seeing there is that those symptoms are getting better the second time around. And that's because we think that it relates to some of the nanomaterials activating something called complement, which is another part of your immune system. And actually, with the second exposure, that those features get less. In contrast, what we were talking about in the previous question, so-called reactogenicity, we're exactly right. As your immune system is more robust to that particular antigen, often those side effects can be worse. So people feeling a bit more fluey and muscle aches and headaches, those are more common with subsequent doses, correct?
As jy sê jy kry allergiese reaksies, is daar mense wat allergiese reaksie teen die entstowwe het?
Yes, so, you know, we've been working on our own. We were monitoring this in Sasonkare. We've been monitoring this nationally, and certainly it's well known. With all vaccines, there is a risk. Some people will have allergic reactions and even severe allergic reactions. However, they are incredibly rare as a percentage of all people. So we expect the rate of, for instance, anaphylaxis to a vaccine to be about 1 in 1 million. 1 in 1 million doses. With the mRNA vaccines, it appears that it's slightly higher than that, probably 3 or 4 per million. So still incredibly, incredibly rare. And then the encouraging data around allergic reactions specific to COVID vaccines is that we have had no deaths related to allergy. All of the responses have actually almost seemed to be self-limiting. So unlike a lot of severe reactions, let's say to a peanut, you know, like a typical food allergy, these reactions have seemed to be easily controlled with medicines in vaccine centers. Many people have gone home, they haven't even need to be admitted to hospital. We're also seeing some people with quite mild, what we call urticarial rashes. So those are sort of like wheals. And we're seeing that a few days after the vaccine. And again, almost all of them can respond fine to a bit of antihistamine. And after a week, we're seeing them go away. And those ones, too, are getting better with the second doses. So we're encouraging people with those kinds of reactions to definitely get their second dose.
Jy het nou net gepraat van nanopartikels en dit is natuurlik ook iets wat mense se hare laat rys en dink dit is iets vreemd wat nou in jou liggaam inkom.
I mean, I think this is a general concern, and I don't think that the public should be faulted for this in a way, right? In the sense that whenever there are, you know, new scientific developments, things that we are getting to know, it's right to be concerned. And I think to be worried, there's nothing wrong with being concerned and making sure that something like a vaccine is safe, right? You're 100% correct. When people have heard the terms about nanoparticles, nanomaterials, these things, they've been very alarmed. My view on this, having worked at a kind of a center in the UK in Oxford, when I was doing my training, I worked in a vaccine center there, working on these kinds of materials. One thing that I think it's important to say is that most of these technologies, they don't just arise out of nothing. Scientists and researchers have been working on these technologies to optimize them from the early stages where they just look at it in a few cells in a laboratory, through animal studies to get to the point where we are now, where we're in a position where we can use this kind of technology to make us safe from infections through vaccines. These technologies, they might appear new to the average person who's not familiar with this, but to people in the scientific field, these vaccine technologies are being developed and honed over decades. And in fact, what's interesting about SARS-CoV-2 is in some extent we were quite lucky because some of this had been worked on for the SARS-CoV-1 and also the MERS-CoV viruses that actually because they were so severe, they did not spread sufficiently to cause a problem and then they disappeared. But the vaccine technology that we had been working on as a scientific community was still there. Right. And the same, the mRNA technologies for vaccines are not new. They've been trying to hone them for different infections for several decades. And so it looks new. Some of this stuff has a long background to it. And then the other thing that I think we must say, which is in a way an incredible thing for the field of science and for the field of vaccinology, is that in the space of like, what are we, 8-12 months, we've now vaccinated 4 billion people. More than 4 billion people on the planet have received it. And there has been no other vaccines in history that have had such good tests in humans. And what we're seeing has been overwhelmingly encouraging. In fact, yes, we can get adverse events to vaccines, but it's been so incredibly safe. And that's what I think, to me, is absolutely remarkable. For the future, we actually have to, as we grow and as the planet gets more populated, we will face further viral pandemic threats like this, undoubtedly. And so it's important for us to have the tools and technologies that will allow for us next time to develop a vaccine even faster. And some of this mRNA technology is incredibly powerful in that, in the sense that once you've got a safe vector, in other words, your nanomaterials are safe and you've proved it, and we've now looked at this in 4 billion people. It's incredible. Once you've got that, you can actually quite easily and quickly make it for new variants that might emerge, for new infections and new viruses. I think that it's 100% correct for people to be concerned and to ask questions and to really make sure that as a scientific and as a research community, we are ethically looking and making sure that this is absolute safety. But I think we also need to be really encouraged, and people need to be aware that people around the world in health and vaccines are doing their absolute best and have been doing it for decades to try and get us to the position where we've been able to do this. So I think that the public also needs to understand both sides of the coin.
Is daar reeds plekke, of dink jy dit sal in die toekoms nog verder gebeur, dat mens so sê dat hierdie vaksine eintlik jou eie immuunrespons uitlok, dat dit van toepassing kan wees op die behandeling van ander type siektes, nie net die virus nie, maar miskien sê maar in onkologie, kankerbehandeling of ek dink byvoorbeeld aan die inspuitings wat hulle deesdae kan gee as jy gevorderde melanoom het, is dit nie dieselfde tipe beginsel wat hulle toepas nie.
Yes, I mean the application of vaccine technology is very broad. And then the other thing I would say is that we also seeing some very interesting other aspects about vaccines. So for instance, we have been involved in a revaccination trial with BCG vaccine, which is the old TB vaccine, that has good protection against TB meningitis, but unfortunately hasn't been successful in keeping people from getting TB. But one of the things they noticed with that vaccine is that actually it helped protect you against other non-TB bugs, so other viruses and other bacteria. And so that was the reason why we actually started this trial, and hopefully those results will come out in about 2 months or so. So we're very excited for seeing whether or not BCG can actually protect you potentially against COVID. But what is already in the public domain is data that shows that in older people, so I mentioned older people as having immunities that actually decline, we can use a vaccine like BCG to prevent them from getting all respiratory tract viruses. And they've now shown that in a trial called the Activate trial, where they showed giving people a booster with BCG when they're over 65 decreased all kinds of respiratory tract infections. That's another application of vaccines that's non-specific. And then what you were talking about with respect to cancer immunotherapies, that is really a very exciting field. And it does use a similar technology, but it's on a personalized basis. And that's what's quite remarkable about it, is that tumors, and often even specific tumors that an individual might have a particular set of mutations that occur in them that means that they express on the surface of those cells, their tumor cells, particular antigens. And what this cancer vaccine technology is doing is it's taking that person's tumor, getting their T cells and waking them up to those particular tumor antigens in that tumor, and then giving those cells back to them, the person, in order to go and fight those tumor. They obviously, it's a huge field immunologically, and there's some other interesting aspects of the immunology related to cancer therapeutics. But some of the principles behind vaccine technology are definitely being implemented in that context.
As jy entstowwe gee, dit lok dan die immuunrespons uit. Julle wil sekerlik nie hê die immuunrespons moet so erg wees dat dit 'n sitokienstorm veroorsaak nie, dat dit begin verwoestend raak vir die liggaam nie. Hoe weet julle dit lok genoeg immuunreaksie uit, maar dit is nie vernietigend vir die liggaam nie?
The question you're asking is absolutely fundamental to the basic science of vaccines. So if you take, for instance, the mRNA vaccines, what they have done there is they have changed, like for instance, they purify out the double-stranded RNA from the vaccine, because double-stranded RNA is a very potent trigger of the innate immune system. That really is the kind of trade-off. In other vaccines, you might have heard of the term an adjuvant. And an adjuvant is something that they add to a vaccine to make it more immunogenic, to make the immune system wake up more. So essentially designing a vaccine is exactly that. It's a trade-off between trying to wake up the immune system enough to make a robust enough response that your protection stays sufficiently long and doesn't just disappear in the first month, and not waking up the immune system too much to cause people to have side effects of having a very activated immune system or any tissue damage from an activated immune system. So really, like all vaccine platforms, whether it's, you know, you've taken a whole virus and inactivated it and try to give it to someone, or whether you've taken a particular spike protein or receptor binding domain protein and tried to only give somebody the genetic material of that, or package it into another kind of virus or something like that. All of those technologies, all of them are being optimized to try to do that balance. And sometimes it's the difference between a one dose or a two dose strategy, how you optimize that, right? Because it's a trade-off, like you don't want to give the person too many side effects, but you want them to have a response that's protecting them, right? So you spot on with that question, and that is the main role that basic scientists function in terms of trying to develop new vaccines, is getting that balance right. So far, we've done pretty well.
Professor Pieter, mens sien dikwels, of mens hoor dikwels, dat daar in een gesin, sê maar 'n ouma en 'n oupa en 'n dogter is wat sterf. Binne 3 weke is daar 3 mense in een gesin dood. Is daar enigszins sprake van 'n genetiese faktor wat betrokke is?
Yes, so I mean, we definitely have unfortunately heard of those tragic scenarios where several members of a family are deceased from SARS-CoV, and there is data that's emerging on genetic risk factors for more severe disease. There's been some lovely publications which have highlighted that problems with the type 1 interferon responses. So again, to go back to the innate immune system and those early, like your respiratory epithelium, your respiratory tract, and then also those signaling molecules that are released very early from your epithelial cells and from your innate immune cells, those little signaling molecules are critical in waking up an early response. SARS-CoV has got a lot of strategies to try and get around that immune thing and allow it to get hold of your body before it sounds those signals. And so what we've seen is that some people with genetic problems in that pathway are more at risk for severe disease. And then interestingly, we've also found that some people make like an what's called an autoantibody. In fact, they sort of make, you know, in the context of autoimmune disease, so almost like an overactive immune system. And some people make autoantibodies to those little interferon molecules, and that puts them at risk for more severe single infections. And then we are on a sort of population level also seeing some hits in terms of the kind of different parts of the immune system that probably make people a little bit more susceptible. So undoubtedly, and unfortunately, that science just hasn't moved quick enough to get implemented readily. That's what we hope, is that we can get to the stage where we could say, okay, you might be 30, but because of your genetics, you're more at risk for severe disease. Unfortunately, we just haven't got fast enough to that. But it doesn't mean that the science isn't emerging, that definitely we are seeing that there are certain genetic risk factors related to immunology that put you at higher risk for severe disease. Yeah.
Sal mense met auto-immuunsiektes 'n hoër risiko hê om sleg te vaar met COVID?
That's a very good question. And I think that what's complicated about teasing that apart is often autoimmune disease gives you damage to your organs. So it can give you like cardiovascular disease with kidney problems or with heart problems. And those risk factors we know put you into a higher risk group. And then the other thing is that we give patients with those autoimmune diseases immune suppressing drugs. Do you know what I mean? So some of the immune suppressing drugs we give blanketly target across several of your cellular or antibody responses. And we know that those people don't make adequate vaccine responses and they don't fight infections as well as the next people. So yes, several of those groups unfortunately do fall into a higher risk category for more severe disease. That's very topical at the moment in the context of many high income countries where they are discussing at the moment, they're discussing it in the CDC about giving extra doses of vaccine to immunocompromised people. And that's the reason for that, is the underlying problems with the immune system. And I guess it's also an ethical debate, because should they be getting high income when there's several people that have never got one vaccine yet? But you're 100% correct in terms of risk for severe disease, but it's not quite a simple answer.
Engeland het al heelwat mense ingeënt, groot persentasie, en hulle het nou weer alles oopgestel. Mense kon na Wimbledon toe gaan, hulle kan na die sokker toe gaan. Verwag mens dat COVID weer sal toeneem, maar mens hoop dat die sterfte syfer in hospitalisasie sal binne perke bly. Is daar al tekens dat dit so is, of is dit nog te vroeg om te sê?
I think for South Africa, it's too early to say. I mean, we've only just got our vaccine program really rolling. You know, we've just crossed the 9 million mark. And so I think it's for us, like the third wave, we're not seeing that. You know, we still had really been, the health systems have really been swamped and overloaded to the point of breaking with the burden of hospitalizations. But I do think that, you know, you mentioned the UK. I do think that the UK are seeing that. They are seeing now an outbreak and expanding case numbers of Delta, but that's not matched by expanding numbers of hospitalizations. And so I do think that there is a level of immunity, a level of vaccination, which will allow you to more confidently start opening up and resuming activities. I think what we have to, I guess, be prepared for is the fact that it might be up and down. We might continue to see outbreaks. And also the other thing is, you know, a lot of people in COVID, and to me, have made generalizations. We've wanted to generalize, you know, we want to quickly understand how it's going to be for us. And I think that one of the problems has been that actually being a sort of outbreak disease, it's often been on different time courses. The natures of the epidemic and the natures of the outbreak have been different in different countries. And so people are trying to do their best to get that balance right. And I do think it will improve as we get to the point where we've got sufficient vaccine coverage, we do have some degree of immunity. But I think it might be a situation where, you know, we open up for a while and then we might see an outbreak in a particular area and need to contract in the area and take care again. And I think that might go on for some years. And I think, I guess we have to get used to that.
Hoe sien jy die toekoms? Wat dink jy gaan gebeur in die volgende jaar, 2-3 jaar, wat betref COVID en Corona SARS-CoV-2?
Again, as a disclaimer for an expert, they say that experts are terrible at predicting the future because a lot of the time the technologies and things that actually change the future, you're not even aware of, they come from another field. But I think I would have to say at this point that I agree with some aspects of what Shabir Madi's been talking about. And I saw recently yesterday an article from Andy Pollard, who heads up the vaccine committee in the UK. And essentially along the lines of saying that the herd immunity horse has bolted, in the sense that that's no longer an option for us, and that we are likely to continue to see outbreaks of SARS-CoV across the globe. But what I hope is that, you know, we continue with our global efforts on vaccination. And what we hope to do, and I think really we are sort of wrapping our minds around the fact that what we can hope to achieve is a state where we're allowed to have, you know, small outbreaks of SARS-CoV ongoingly, potentially for maybe 2-3 years or several years, but that it doesn't overwhelm our health system because we have sufficient vaccine coverage to prevent severe disease and hospitalizations. And I think that is the reality. I guess one other aspect that a lot of people have really balked against, you know, masks and the social implications of the pandemic, and I think those have really been vast, and we're experiencing, you know, mental health pandemics and all other negative consequences. But I must say, from an immunology perspective, I saw some data reported about influenza season and the fact that if you look at influenza cases over the last couple of years, you'll see that in the last like year or in this year, where did the influenza go? I also read a lovely tweet from a Japanese researcher that said that in their culture, it's routine community respect when you are sick or when you are having a thing or if your child is sick to wear a mask. To wear a mask in public and to wear a mask at school. And I think, like, I hope that we can sort of in our minds come to terms with that. That's actually, you know, caring for everyone in the context of making sure that we don't unnecessarily spread infectious diseases. That will potentially be maybe a positive that could come out of it. In the same way, I've tried to focus you on the positives of immunology and the positives of vaccines, which I think there are a lot in the context of SARS-CoV-2. I think we should keep that in mind as well for the future.
Net jou finale boodskap in een sin. Wat wil jy hê die luisteraar moet onthou as hy net een ding moet onthou?
The sort of take-home message for me is that our immune systems are great. we mustn't forget that our immune systems protect us from invading pathogens and viruses all the time. I run a clinic where I look after people whose immune systems don't work so well. And they are riddled and really debilitated and often lead to death from bad infections. So I think that although we're seeing this terrible infection cross the planet, I think we must be awed and wondered and amazed by the fact that for the most part, our immune systems are working. And in addition, I think the similarly, our scientific communities are doing everything they can and have in record time produced vaccines which are helping our immune system, even in those people that are not seeing infections, to save their life and keep them out of hospital. And so I think, like, my overwhelming message for listeners is, despite what you hear, and there's a lot of negativity, to, you know, really sort of embrace like how amazing our human immune system is and how our science has really got us to the point where we can do such a lot in such a short space of time. So it is a tough time with the infection, but I think, like, I love the immune system, I guess.
Baie dankie aan professor Jonathan Pieter, hoof van kliniese immunologie en allergie aan die Universiteit van Kaapstad se Mediese Skool en die Groote Schuur Hospitaal en verbonde aan die Long Instituut van die universiteit.